All right, time for us to start. I've returned the first two labs to you. Got those returned to you yesterday. The way it works, and I don't know, there's probably a better way to do this, but those of you that actually uploaded it to the Dropbox get it back in the Dropbox, so that's where you go. If your partner uploaded it, then I sent it to you in your MetNet email. I'm sure there's some way in D2L to return it to you, but I just haven't found it yet. So look in the Dropbox if you submitted it. Look in your email if your partner submitted it. Grades are in there for the first two labs and first two homeworks, so check that out to make sure everything is correct and let me know if anything needs changing. We already talked, the answer key for quiz one and a blank are in content in D2L. You have to finish the chapter three assignment in Mastering Chemistry by this Friday. So let's talk a little bit about our first exam, which is coming up a week from today. The way I do it, most of the points on our exams will come from multiple choice questions, and I guarantee you that's not because I'm lazy and don't like grading things. It's because the final exam that you'll take in here, the standardized exam from the American Chemical Society, is completely multiple choice. So it'll be to your advantage to get to know how to do multiple choice questions. Unfortunately for you, that does not mean that these questions are easy either. I agonize for hours and hours and hours over how to write the absolutely best multiple choice questions that I can. I will never write a trick question. Okay? A lot of students will think things are trick questions. I will never write a question to purposely deceive you, but I will write pretty difficult questions that test whether you fully understand the concept that we're talking about. So if you haven't had an awful lot of experience taking multiple choice exams, I highly recommend that you practice up on them. Okay? Multiple choice is sort of a skill on its own, so make sure you practice up on that. I do have practice exams on the webpage. Some of them are ones that I've written. It was a long time ago, but they are ones that I've written. There are also ones that they use at the University of Minnesota that cover, that come from a very similar textbook, although the material per exam is covered a little bit differently, so watch out for that. What I'm thinking now is 20 to 25 multiple choice questions, some short answer for doing some chemical naming, names and formulas, maybe writing or balancing chemical equations, and then we'll probably do two show your work problems that may have a couple of parts to each, right? So you'll have the entire class time to do it. I'll write it to be finished in that class time, but you probably won't have an awful lot of time to spare. So I especially recommend you going through these practice exams and timing yourself on them. It's one thing to be able to do a question if you've got 15 or 20 minutes to think about that one question. It's another thing entirely to be able to do a question in 2 minutes. So I think your goal would be to go through practice exams and be able to do a multiple choice question in 2 minutes. So give yourself 10 questions and 20 minutes to do them, for instance. That would be a goal for you to try to get to. So, and as you're practicing for an exam, again, it's one thing to be able to look at a question and say, yeah, that makes sense. There's something like that in the notes. There's something entirely different to be able to have a question and to be able to do that question entirely on a blank piece of paper without looking back at your notes or without looking back at the text and without peeking at the answer or anything. So make sure you go that extra step, because there's a big difference between having just familiarity to a problem and actually being able to do it while you're being timed and without any assistance from other places. So a lot of students that come in to me after we've had this first exam will tell me that these questions were a lot harder than the ones that we did before. And they'll say, and a lot of students will say that it may not seem related or something like that. And those are the students that have only tried to memorize the exact types of problems and things that we've done. You really have to make sure that you're understanding why it is that we're doing the things that we're doing. There are going to be questions on this exam that don't look an awful lot like the things that we've done in here. But if you understand why it is that we did the things that we did, and if you understand the patterns and the rules and the concepts behind these things, you should be able to apply this stuff to new situations. Okay? The exam will have some questions that just test on a familiar basis. Okay? There are questions that should be familiar to you if you've paid attention in here. There'll be questions that take what we've done and apply it beyond that. So that's why you really need to be making sure that you're understanding the concepts behind this, especially practicing the end of chapter problems. I've assigned the whole series of problems from each chapter in the syllabus. Students that do well in this class have typically done all of those end of chapter problems. Students that are surprised by the difficulty of exam questions or get caught off guard by exam questions typically have not done those end of chapter problems. So that's a very key relationship that I've found over teaching this class. So really don't think that you'll be able to just, you know, read through the notes and see the stuff that makes sense and stuff that looks familiar to you and think you'll be able to replicate that on the exam. It really takes a good amount of work and a good amount of practice, especially on those problems on your own, to be able to do well on there. Okay? So I promise you, there are a lot of students that are surprised by that. A lot of students that don't take my advice on that end up with a disappointing score on that first exam. So the mastering chemistry exercises, after it's due, you can go back in and rework them for practice. So especially if you use those hints in mastering chemistry to get the assignments done, go back sometime and make sure you can do those same problems without using hints. Besides, when you go back into them, I think to you do them for practice, it gives you a new randomization. So it's not going to be exactly the same question that you did before. Okay? So does that make sense to everybody? Anybody have questions about any of that? So I promise you, though, it takes a good amount of practice, a good amount of preparation to be able to do well on here. If you're shooting for an A in this class, which I know lots of you are, if you're shooting for an A in this class, you need to be doing all of those end of chapter problems. I promise you, that's pretty much what it takes. So if you're able to do those, and if you're able to write problems on a blank piece of paper and do them without referring back to the text, without referring back to your notes, and to do those in a reasonable amount of time, then you'll be able to do well. Okay? Any questions? Well,
just one quick question.
I'm sorry?
Regarding the calculators, it's just the final that we get in this graphing.
That's right. You can use a graphing calculator, you can use whatever calculator you want on the unit exams. I'm not particular about that, but the American Chemical Society is particular about it. So. Okay. All right. Other questions? So I introduced you to our series of polyatomic ions towards the end of last time. The ones that I have written out on here, I consider to be sort of the minimum set of information that you need in order to figure out what all of the polyatomic ions are that we need to be aware of. Okay? So these are not all of the polyatomic ions, but you can take these and you can modify them to get to pretty much all of the common polyatomic ions. So I gave you one rule, one little pattern that you can do in order to convert these into a related set. You can remove an oxygen. You can change the 8 ending to ite while leaving the charge the same. So 8 and ite are a pair of related compounds that are just different by one oxygen. And that's it. So nitrite, phosphite, chlorite, sulfite, are related to their 8 counterparts, just minus 1 oxygen. The other thing we can do, we'll come back to, let's do the hypo and per. The halogens, okay? The ones with chlorine, the ones that have chlorine or some other halogen as part of their formula, typically have more than 2 oxyanions. Okay? More than two possible numbers of oxygen. So if there are more than two of them in the series, we need to use hypo and per. So let me write for you the series of I'll write for you the series of chlorine ones, but it really works for all the halogens. So ClO minus ClO2 minus ClO3 minus ClO4 minus. What's the only thing that's different in all of these?
Number of
oxygens. Okay. Be very careful. Number in the bottom is how many oxygens. Up on top is the charge. They all have the same charge.
I'm sorry. Is there any way that it's
not blinking?
Blinking. The whole screen is
blinking. The corner. Is that disruptive?
Yes.
Okay. You're welcome. All right. Only different by one oxygen. These are also, this also works for bromine. BROX minus IOX. Okay. So, the one that I gave you up above here was ClO3 with a minus charge. That one is chlorate, which means, what is ClO2 with a minus charge?
Chlorite.
So, when we have a series of four of them, 8 nites are in the middle. Okay? 8 will be the lower of the middle, the 8 will be the larger number of oxygens in the middle two. For the ones beyond that, we use hypo and per. Hypo means below or under. Right? So hypo has fewer oxygens yet. So what we'll do is take chlorite and make it hypochlorite. Per means like all or every or something like that. So chlorate becomes perchlorate. So be careful. It's chlorite that became hypochlorite. It's chlorate that became perchlorate. So remember I said this also works with the bromines and the iodine. So there's hypobromite, bromite, bromate, and perbromate. Hypoiodite, iodite, iodate, periodate. Okay? So works for those halogens, starting with chlorine. Doesn't work so much with fluorine, but the ones chlorine and below, that works. Right? So also there are some polyatomic ions that have an added H plus to these base ions. So in terms of acids and bases, and we'll talk later on about what exactly is going on. But what we need to know now is that addition of H plus will reduce the negative charge by one. That should make sense, right? If we add a plus to it, it'll cancel out one of those minuses. So, especially the ones with the larger charges, okay, the two minuses and the three minuses. Let's do sulfate. Sulfate. Okay? Sulfate is SO4, two minus. Hydrogen sulfate is HSO4. With what charge? Yeah, single minus. So, adding a hydrogen in front of the name, the systematic way to name those now is to call it hydrogen sulfate, but there's a informal name that's been used for a long time that is still seen in a lot of places. So hydrogen sulfate is also known as bisulfate. Oops.
We need to know what both of them, or just...
You should be able to recognize either of them. I will accept either of them if you've given them. Okay? So you may encounter a name that says hydrogen sulfate, or you may encounter a name that says bisulfate. Okay? It's very commonly used with carbonate, CO3-2-, so hydrogen carbonate, what's the formula of hydrogen carbonate? HCO3 with what charge?
Negative.
Yeah, single minus. And hydrogen carbonate is also known as what? Bicarbonate. Okay? So, be careful. I'm going to make my space very big there. It actually is two words, hydrogen carbonate. Okay? Bicarbonate, though, is one word. So, I don't know what the original source of that bi was when we're adding a hydrogen. It's kind of weird, but if we've added an H plus to any of those ions, we can call it bi, or we can just call it hydrogen. Okay. So, I think, like I said last time, it would make sense for you to make flashcards of these ones, because that's sort of the minimum amount of information. Learn these rules and apply them to as many of these as you can. I even have bicarbonate written on here. It's a pretty common one, just to show you how those rules work. Okay? So I would maybe just make a sheet of paper where you've got those base ones and you modify them with those rules just for practice. And then what you can do is have just a column of names, and then you write out the formulas next to them, and then on another sheet write out a whole column of formulas, and for practice you write in the names next to them. And see if you can get to the point where you can do that without looking at any kind of cheat sheets or anything. You will need to know how to convert any of these between their names and the formulas, because these ions are used very commonly in many compounds. Turns out most ionic compounds actually have one of these polyatomic ions in them. So to be able to write a name or to write a formula for an ion requires that you know what these polyatomic ions are. Right? Any questions about those?
When you add a hydrogen, positive hydrogen, to any of those, can you change it to, like, say, biphosphate? Does that rule apply to every one of those?
Yep. If it's a 3-, we could actually add one hydrogen, or we could add another hydrogen. So PO4 3-, I'll write those down here on the bottom. It's phosphate, HPO4 2-, or H2PO4-. Okay. If you start with a 1-, you can't add an H to that and still call it an ion, because then it would be a neutral compound. So this is just using naming of these ions. So here's phosphate. If there's a possibility to add more than one, the bi is not very commonly used. So I would call this one hydrogen phosphate. Any ideas what I'd call this one? Sure, dihydrogen. Okay. So, I think that only really applies to phosphate, because phosphate's the only 3- that we're learning here anyway. Any of the 2-s can have a single hydrogen added to them. Okay? Questions about that? So, let's use some of those. I have a formula written right up here, CuSO4. What is the ratio of how many ions there are in this compound? 1 to what? There's one copper ion. Yeah. This is a 1-to-1 ratio of ions. How come it's not a 1-to-4 ratio? There's only one what? Yeah, there's only one. There's a positive ion and a negative ion, okay? With the proper charges, okay? So copper is variable charge, so we'll have to figure out its charge in a second. SO4, might have to look back a page, but what charge does SO4 have?
2-.
Since it's a 1-to-1 ratio, what does that mean about the charges whenever it's a 1-to-1 ratio? Yeah, they're equal and opposite, right? So copper is what? 2+. Name of this is copper. Copper what? Copper sulfate. Close.
Copper
2. Sulfate. Anytime it's a variable charge positive ion, which means it's anything except group 1, group 2, aluminum, zinc, silver. Right? Those are the only fixed charge positive ions that we talked about. Group 1, group 2, aluminum, zinc, silver. Looking at your periodic table. Any other metal is variable charge. So that means we always need this Roman numeral number 2 here. That number 2 stands for what? The charge. Yeah, that's the positive charge of this copper ion. Okay? So, groups again today. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. Two groups over here. Finish these two. Okay? I've given you a name, cobalt 2 nitrite. Write its ions, then write its formula. I've given you a formula on the bottom, MnPO4 parentheses 2. Write those ions, and then give that a name. Okay, just a minute, see what we can get. So let's compare. Let's go the group in the middle in the back there. What is the positive ion in the ion pair?
That would be copper, cobalt.
Cobalt. So symbol CO. What charge?
Positive 2.
2+. The negative ion is what?
Is a nitrite.
NO2 with a minus charge. Everybody write NO2 with a minus charge? How come it's not NO3? Yeah. You look at your list. Nitrate is NO3. This is nitrite. So it needs one fewer oxygen. Okay? So those are the ions. That looks good. Somebody from the group over to my right over here. Formula. CO what? NO2 parentheses 2. Okay. So, what do those parentheses show? Yeah, I show that I have two polyatomic ions in the formula. Well, two of the same one, right? Two copies of nitrite within this formula. And how is it that you figured out this number 2 goes over to the right here? Anyone?
22 oxygens.
Yeah, this one way out here outside the parentheses, where's that one come from? Mm-hmm. Why do you need those? Why do you need two nitrites? Yeah, to make a 1-to-2 ratio, right? We'll need a 1-to-2 ratio of these ions for the compound to be what?
Neutral.
Good. All right. Let's do the last one. You guys in front. Positive ion, Mn. What charge did you put on Mn? Over here. What did you guys put? 6+?
6+.
Negative ion is PO4 with what charge?
3-.
Okay, so tell me how you got that 6+. Yeah. Looked at the charge of phosphate, which is 3-. Okay. So you have two of them in the formula and one Mn. So in order for it to be neutral, right, we have a 1-to-2 ratio for it to be neutral. That's what charge Mn has to have. Okay? So, ladies in the back, what is Mn? Manganese. So this compound will be manganese what? 6. So I should write manganese parentheses what? Bi. Then what?
Phosphate.
Okay. Anybody have questions? Yes?
Technical question. Mm-hmm. Is it appropriate to always capitalize the first or leave it lowercase?
On their own, chemical names are not capitalized. What is the only time when a chemical name would be capitalized? In your lab report, for instance. Yeah, when it's at the beginning of a sentence, the first word of it would be capitalized, but otherwise not. Okay? It is important to capitalize element symbols, but compound names themselves are not. That's a good question. I think mastering chemistry will tell you to check your capitalization, for instance. Yeah. And I might make a mark on your lab report, for instance, and if it's a recurring problem, I'll start taking points off for it. Yeah. I'll be lenient towards the beginning anyway. Okay? So, just quickly defining what a hydrate is. A hydrate contains a certain number of water molecules per formula unit. So hydrates are ionic compounds, so it's got positive and negative ions all lined up in an ionic lattice, but there's a certain number of water molecules that's contained within that ionic structure as well. So CuSO4, and it's given by that dot, so dot with 5H2O. That means for every one copper ion, for every one sulfate ion, there are 5 water molecules. So sort of like a 1-to-1-to-5 ratio of the different things that are in this ionic compound. So name of this would be copper 2, what's SO4?
Sulfate.
Pentahydrate. So, on the next page, we'll have these prefixes, but penta means 5. So, name of this compound is copper 2 sulfate pentahydrate. We can actually drive the water molecules off of this. Okay? If I have CU, it typically will tend to have water molecules in it, if it so chooses. Okay? So, if I had copper sulfate that was pure without any water, but I just left it sitting out in the air, it would absorb water molecules from water vapor in the air. We can remove those water molecules, though. Any idea how we would remove them? It's the same way you would remove water from your clothes. Yeah. You would evaporate it. What do you do? Yeah. Yeah, heat. So if you take a sample of that copper sulfate, if you literally put it in an oven or put it in a ceramic dish with a flame to it, you'll be able to evaporate those water molecules and we'll have CuSO4 just pure. This is called copper 2 sulfate. Anybody know the official chemical word for meaning for without water? Yeah. Anybody that's worked on a farm has heard of anhydrous ammonia. That means it's got all of its water removed through a dehydration process. So that's just having a little nomenclature behind it, and also understanding that this means that if you're, for instance, calculating the formula weight for this, you do one copper, one sulfur, four oxygens, and then five waters would all add up to the molar mass of this compound. Okay? So let's move on from ionic compounds, which always have a positive and a negative ion, and ionic compounds are always named for their positive ion and for their negative ion. Okay? Moving to molecular compounds, we have a different set of rules. So, first of all, is it a molecular compound? If it is a binary, and what does binary mean? Just two elements and some ratio, but only two different elements. So if it is binary molecular, what kind of elements will those two elements be? I heard one metal and one non-metal? If we looked back at ionic compounds like sodium chloride, that would be one metal and one non-metal. Yeah. Binary molecular compound made of two non-metals. Molecular compounds have non-metals only in their formula. That's because there's not any ionic bonding. It's that difference, it's that sharing of electrons called covalent bonding, which we talked about before, that non-metals do. So if we have a formula that's some ratio of two non-metals, we switch to these rules. It's a binary molecular compound. They use Greek prefixes in their name to show how many atoms are in the formula. So I've given you 1 through 4 anyway. 1, 2, 3, 4. Mono, di, tri, tetra. Okay. 5 and 6 are ones that we should already know because they're the same as shapes. Right. So what's 5 going to be? Penta. And 6.
Hexa,
right? 7, hepta, H-E-P-T-A. Okay. 8, octa, nona, and deca. Okay. Those are the Greek prefixes that always refer to how many things there are. So we saw di before when we were doing like dihydrogen phosphate. Okay. We saw penta on the last page when we had a pentahydrate. So anytime we specifically have to indicate quantity of something, we use one of these Greek prefixes. So before we go into these compounds over here, which I'll set you on in just a second, okay, we use these rules for naming it. The first element will have a prefix, right, a Greek prefix, and then the element name, but we don't use mono for the first element. If there's just one of the first element, we use just the element name, and that's it. Okay? So that's why I put mono in parentheses up here. Mono is only used for the second element. Okay? The second element will be a prefix, then an element root plus ide. So the exact same way we named single atom ions, like fluoride and chloride and bromide and oxide and nitride and sulfide and so on. Okay. There are no ions in this, but the second word has that same sort of structure to it. Okay. Avoid these two vowel combinations. Avoid AO and OO. So if you have an AO, right, like oxide, right, hepta, it's not going to be heptaoxide, it's going to be heptoxide. Okay. So avoid AO and OO. So just together, what's this first one going to be? NO2. What's the first word going to be? Nitrogen. Not mononitrogen. Mono is only used when? The second one. Okay? So, nitrogen, then what? Dioxide. Okay? Do these other ones. Okay. Compare them with your group members. Middle three are pretty common compounds that we'll be talking about. The last one is just sort of silly, but just to see if we can follow the rules. probably doesn't even exist, but we can use the rules anyway to figure it out. Looks like we should have got through most of them. I think we got through all the groups. Let's start over here on my right. What's the first word for N2O4?
Any idea?
Dinitrogen. Okay. Dinitrogen, then what?
Tetroxide.
Okay. It's not tetraoxide, it's tetroxide. Okay? All right. Down here in front, second one, what is it? It's carbon monoxide. All heard of carbon monoxide, the colorless, odorless gas that will kill you overnight if your furnace is malfunctioning, for instance, right? Carbon monoxide uses those exact rules that we talked about. I'll give you guys an easy one. What's CO2? Very good. Carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide. Right? I included these because they're things that we've all heard of, and they exemplify the rules for naming these binary molecular compounds. We don't call it monocarbon monoxide, we call it carbon monoxide. We don't call it carbon monoxide, we call it carbon monoxide. Right? So, if you know these two, you already know the rules for naming these binary molecular compounds. Okay? So, I'll split this last one up. What's the first word for P2O7?
Diphosphorus.
Okay? Diphosphorus. Okay? What's the second word? This one. What's it?
Heptoxide.
Okay. Questions on those? Those are pretty simple. Do a couple of those. You'll have those down without a problem. Variation on our molecular compounds come in the form of acids. We will, at this point in this class, I guess in second semester we'll have a much better definition, but at this point we'll just call an acid a formula with H as its first element. Very commonly, almost always, an acid will be written with an H first, so that's just sort of symbolic of it being an acid. As we'll learn in detail later on, acids release H plus ions when they're dissolved in water. That's what makes them acidic, those H plus, those protons. They will be named as a normal binary molecular compound when they are pure. I'll show you what I mean by that. A binary acid, right, will have just H and one other non-metal. So just like our binary molecular compounds, except we have a subset now where we have H as the first one and then something else. So the names of binary acids will start with hydro and end with ic acid. So here's what I mean by named as a normal binary molecular compound when they're pure. HCl, when it is pure, is a gas. So, and when I mean pure, I mean only a sample of HCl. It's molecules where there's an H attached to a Cl. So if I were naming that, just like we did on the last page, what would I call this? Yeah, let's call it hydrogen chloride. We skip the mono if there's no possibility for having anything more than one. So H with a if you imagined ionic charges, H with a plus and Cl with a minus, there's no other opportunity for there to be anything other than just one of each. So hydrogen chloride gas is what this is. So that's what pure HCl is. You can get it in a compressed gas cylinder, and it contains those molecules. Meant to fix this in the notes. The name of this is not binary acid. HCl is a binary acid, and it has this AQ phase label. It's the first time we've seen that in this class. What does that mean? Yeah, aqueous, which means it is what? Dissolved in water. Okay? That's different from an L phase label. What does L mean?
Liquid.
But what's the difference between AQ and L? Yeah. If you have a pure substance, which itself is a liquid, that gets the L phase label. If you've taken any old thing and dissolved it in water, that is the AQ phase label. Big, big difference between those. Okay? So, acids only act as acids, because right here. Because they release those H plus ions only when they're dissolved in water. So something will only act as an acid, at least for our naming purposes here, when it's been dissolved in water. So HCl, dissolved in water, is a binary acid. We will name it as a binary acid. It starts with hydro, it ends with ic acid. HCl is the most famous of all the acids. So what's it called? Hydrochloric acid. It's the hydro as the ic acid. The chlor just comes from the element that's not hydrogen. Pretty simple, right? Write the names for these other binary acids on your paper. Also write the name for this last thing that I've written down. All right, so let's bang through these quick. Over to my right here, HF. What's that? Hydro. Hydrofluoric acid, okay. In front, HBr, AQ. Okay. In the middle, HI. Right? Okay. In front here to my left, HBr gas. It's called what? That's right. So, one thing that we'll use to classify acids is the type of negative ion that's involved in them. So if we imagine H plus, then the other ion is some sort of minus in these cases. Right? So Cl minus, F minus, Br minus, I minus. What do the names of those ions all end in? Think of what Cl minus is. Ide, right? For instance, I minus is iodide. Ate and ite all have oxygens in them, but ide is just an ion alone by itself. So, in order to make into a binary acid, if the ion ends in ide, like all of these do, the acid will be called hydro something ic acid. So iodide makes hydroiodic acid, bromide makes hydrobromic acid, fluoride, and so on. Okay? That also means even though this one is not binary, what is the CN minus ion? Anybody know? I think it's on your list. No, it's actually not on your list. I'll give you this one. It's pretty common. Cn minus ion is the cyanide ion. Okay. So even though this is not binary, since the ion ends in ide, what's going to be the name of this acid? HCN hydrocyanic acid. Okay. So this right here is just sort of the ultimate rule. For any negative ion ending in ide, when we make an acid out of it, it becomes a hydro something ic acid. So we're going to compare that to oxy acids, which have hydrogen and then some ion that contains oxygen and another element. Okay? Just like our sheet of polyatomic ions. Okay? So if we have H plus with one of those negative polyatomic ions, that's going to make what we call an oxy acid. So use the oxy anion, so use the negative ion in order to name the oxy acid. So if it ends in 8, the acid becomes an ic acid. If it ends in ite, it is an us acid. So I've got a breakthrough on it. HNO3. So let's do this first one together. HNO3 has H plus as a positive ion, NO3 minus as a negative ion. So NO3 minus is what? Yeah. There's NO3 minus, there's NO2 minus. So NO3 minus is nitrate. So if we're naming it as an acid, HNO3 will be what? Nitric, nitrous. So from 8, 8s become ic. Okay. You know what to do. Go to it. You can probably guess what HNO2 is going to be. There's no hydro. Hydro only comes when we had an ion that ended in ide. Okay? Mm-hmm. Yep. The H in front doesn't mean hydro. Hydro means the ion ended in ide for whatever reason. And assume these are all AQ. Visible. So being able to name these sort of requires two bits of information. You need to know your polyatomic ions and their names precisely, and you need to know that ites become ic acid, ites become us acid. One more minute, see if you can get through all these. When we get to it, I'm going to ask one of the groups why there are three hydrogens in H3PO4. So make sure you know why that is. you finished, I gave you one more. Sort of makes sense based on the last three that we did. So. Alrighty. Group, ladies in the back to my left, did you get the first one, HNO2? What was it? Nitrous, there you go. That's because it had a nitrite ion in it, so it became nitrous acid. Okay? Over here on my right, H3PO4. Phosphoric acid. It's phosphoric. It has an ick because what's this ion in here? Phosphate. Okay. And why are there three hydrogens in H3PO4? Yeah. In order for it to be a neutral compound, we need three H pluses because phosphate is PO4. 3 minus. So if I have H plus PO4 3 minus, that's the compound I get from this. Okay, so that is phosphoric acid. In front here, HClO3. Chloric. Because the negative ion was what? Chlorate. Yeah, right? In the middle, HClO2.
Chlorous.
Because it had a chlor what in its? In its ion. Chlorite. Okay? In front here, HClO. Hypochlorous. Because the ClO minus ion is what? Hypochlorite. Okay? So, by that same logic, what's HClO4? Anybody? Per? Yeah. Perchloric. It's a perchloric, not us, because it's perchlorate that it came from. So, that's why I gave you these rules here. All you need to do is know what the ending of the negative ion is to tell you which of the three kinds of acids it is. So on our last page, these all were ide ions. And reviewing this is good review for naming ions themselves. Right? So all of these were ide ions. So those ide were the ones that started with hydro. Okay? All of the 8 and the ite ones were either were just ick and just us, no hydro, if it's an 8 or an ite. Okay? Questions? All right. Please practice those. I guarantee on exam 1 there's going to be some points devoted to knowing whether or not you can name acids. So moving along, we've got some calculations to do in this chapter. So I'll spend the rest of our time today and all the time next time we're dealing with some chemistry calculations. So let's start with something very close to what we dealt with before. Formula mass of a compound is the sum of atomic masses of all the atoms. So just like we had atomic mass in AMU, formula mass is just the mass of the entire formula in AMU. So we won't add this up, but if we looked at our periodic table and got numbers for iron and sulfur and oxygen, though, how many irons would I have to do? Yeah, I'd have to do 2 times whatever iron is. Okay. How many sulfurs? Yeah. How many oxygens? 12. Right? And if you want to check your work later, the number I got was 399.88. AMU for that one. Okay. So multiplying by however many atoms are in the formula, then adding all of those together. And in any calculator, you can just do 2 times 22.99 plus 3 times 16.01 plus, right? So you can do times and plus and times and plus all together, and order of operations will still be correct. Okay? So molar mass of a compound, we've done molar mass of just elements, right? Same as atomic mass, but just with different units, right? Units of grams per mole. So let's see if we can answer this kind of question right here. Oh, by the way, the molar mass of this iron 3 sulfate would be that same number, 399.88 grams per mole. So going above. So we need to use molar mass of a compound in order to answer a question like this. How many water molecules are in 25 milligrams of water? Let's just together make a roadmap, and then I'll leave it to you to figure out this problem. So setting this up as a single unit conversion problem, here's our one given value. Got to start with that. So milligrams we should convert into what? Anyone? Grams. What can I convert grams into using molar mass of water, for instance? Yeah. And then convert moles into what? Molecules. Using somebody's number. Okay. So there's your roadmap. See if you can get that set up. We need a molar mass for that conversion factor. We need Avogadro's number for that conversion factor. Okay. Only thing different from things we were doing last chapter is that now we have a compound. And the only different place that is in its molar mass. You need 2 hydrogens and 1 oxygen. So start with milligrams, set up 1, 2, 3 conversion factors all in a row in order to get an answer. What did everybody get for the molar mass of water? 'Let's start simple. Ladies in the back to my left, what's the first thing you did? 25 milligrams of water, and what? Okay. 1,000 milligrams in a gram. Works for me. You could do 10 to the minus 3 grams in a milligram. Same thing. Okay? Milligrams to gram. Good. Over here to my right, what did you do next? Right. This is molar mass of water. 18.016 grams per mole. Making a conversion factor out of that has 18.016 grams on one side per one mole on the other side of the fraction. Okay. Good so far?
Wouldn't you change? On my third step, I have the 18.016 mole over 1 gram.
No, molar mass is in units of grams per mole. You would do that if it were in units of moles per gram. So molar mass is how many grams there are in one mole of a substance.
I guess I did it that way, so I was doing the...
Yeah. When we have a unit of grams per mole, the number always goes with the first unit. Okay. That makes sense? All right. Then, guys in the middle, what did you do for the last one?
Multiplied by
Avogadro's number. 10 to the 23 water molecules. There are 6.022 times 10 to the 23 water molecules per what? One mole of water. Okay. How many sig figs in this answer?
Two
sig figs? What are the first? What are the two significant figures? Anyone? 8.4. 10 to the 20. When I'm asking you for how many molecules are in something, should that number be a large number or should that be a small number? Yeah, that better be a very large number, because if I have any measurable mass of something, that will contain a very large number of tiny, tiny molecules. Right? So, same calculation we've done in the last chapter. Only addition here is that I used calculated molar mass instead of just the molar mass of an element. Okay? Good? Let's take some of that information and figure out some mass percent composition. This is a useful calculation because in things like fertilizer, it's useful to know what percent of that mass comes from nitrogen and what comes from phosphorus and so on. In fact, any fertilizer you get will have those sort of values written on the box or written on the bag. So knowing what mass in a compound comes from a certain element is the calculation that we get from here. So mass percent is just like any kind of percent. It is an amount of a part divided by amount of the whole times 100. That's what a percent is. That's always how percents are calculated. So for element in a compound, it's just the mass of an element over the total mass of the compound, then times 100 to get it into a percent. So in order to get this from something like a chemical formula, from something like H2O or CaH18, we're going to assume first that we have one mole of the compound, and that means that we can just use molar masses. Okay? If I had a compound with a molar mass of, if I had water, 18.016 grams per mole, if I had one mole of water, what mass would that be? If its molar mass was 18.016 grams per mole, if I had one mole, the mass would be what? Okay, you get the idea. So if we assume one mole, we can use just molar masses just in grams. That's it. So let's do this one. We got a few minutes, so let's just work together. Calculate the molar mass of C8H18. So take 8 carbons and 18 hydrogens. We don't have a periodic table. Carbon is 12.01. Hydrogen is 1.008. So, simple enough calculation. What'd you get? Was it 114? And depending on which periodic table you use, the numbers at the end will be a little different. I got 224, but... Anybody use the periodic table from inside the book? What number did you get? That? Okay. So, what did you get? It's another periodic table? Oh yeah. So, just so you know, depending on the periodic table you use, the number at the end will be a little bit different. That is not going to be a problem for us as long as the molar mass that we're using is not the thing with the fewest sig figs. So typically we'll have some measurement with far fewer sig figs than that, which means that the overall answer will be rounded down an awful lot compared to what that was. So molar mass in a properly constructed question, right, it's not going to matter which periodic table we use. The differences just come from rounding the values, and that's it. Okay? So here's the key question now. 1 mole of C8H18 has how many moles of carbon?
Eight.
And how many moles of hydrogen?
18.
Okay. Think of C8H18 as a structure that contains 8 carbons and 18 hydrogens. So if I have a mole of them, I have 8 moles of carbon. Just like if I had one molecule, I'd have 8 carbon atoms. Right? So all we have to do is figure out mass percent, right? Mass of the element divided by total mass. What am I going to use? Let's start easy. What am I going to use for total mass? Yeah. 114. Right? That's grams total. What about carbon? If I have 114.224 grams, how am I going to figure out how much carbon is in that? It's going to be, carbon itself is 12.01, but that would be if I only had one carbon in the formula. Yeah. See that? That's what we did here. Since 1 mole of C8H18 has 8 moles of carbon, okay, I do 8 carbons right there, and that's the total. So, what'd you get for percent of carbon? Use 4 sig figs. A 4.12. All right. I'll let you write up the formula for the hydrogen here on your own. It's going to be divided by the same thing. What'd you put on the top of this fraction?
18.14.
I did 18 times 1.08. Right? You could multiply that out, but 18 times 1.08 divided by 114.224 times 100, that's all you have to do. What'd you get for this?
15.8.
How could you check your work? If you found all of the elements, they should all add up to 100%. Okay? That's assuming that you did your calculations correctly. Okay. So that's where we'll stop. We'll continue on with that sort of thing and using some conversions in a couple of specialty kind of calculations for next time. Well, that's it. Meet you in the lab in a few minutes.